Hello and welcome to this Clinic Oncology podcast. In this episode, we'll be speaking to Dr. Sophie Otter and Dr. Saif Ahmad about their roles on the editorial board for the Clinic Oncology Journal. Now, I'll let each of us introduce ourselves. My name's Finn Slevin, and I'm a trainee editor for the journal and also a Clinic Oncology Specialty Registrar in Leeds Cancer Centre.
Thanks, Finn. My name is Saif Ahmad. I'm a clinical lecturer in clinical oncology at Addenbrookes Hospital and with the university there. And I've been working with the journal for over 5 years now as an assistant editor and principally in charge as the podcast editor. And really delighted to discuss my role today.
And my name's Sophie Otter. I'm one of the consultant clinical oncologists at the Royal Surrey in Guildford and also one of the advisory editors on the editorial board and have been for the last couple of years.
So thank you both very much for joining us today. We're really grateful for that. So firstly, I'd like to ask, why did you become an editor for clinical oncology?
For me, I guess it was quite an organic experience. There was one of my sort of key supervisors there in Cambridge, Professor Charlotte Coles. She had taken up the editor-in-chief role, was about to some years back. She's now passed that mantle on to Ananya Chowdhury. And around that time, I think the journal was looking at ways to sort of diversify, look at new ways of engaging with younger trainees. So I believe it was around that time, Charlotte, with the rest of the strategy team, were looking at trainees who might be interested in joining on. Myself and Ben O'Leary, actually around that time, ended up joining through when we heard about the opportunity. And then we had some time speaking to people involved with the board and came up with some ideas that we could do to look at refreshing the way that the journal reached out to primarily to sort of younger readership. And one of the things that I was quite keen on was bringing in podcasts, which I thought was a really good companion to some of the written articles that we have, which can be used sort of in a, obviously it's a podcast, which are type sort of audio pieces that involves an interview. We're obviously having one right now, so anyone listening to this would know about them. I just thought that was a nice way to sort of engage with trainees. A lot of the time people are on commutes or at the gym or things like that, and you don't always have the time to read an article. But I thought that was a really nice opportunity. And I think what really excited me about joining the journal, and I think it still holds true, is that sort of opportunity, is that platform. And I'll talk about it a bit more later, I guess, in the podcast, but to be able to sort of develop a podcast platform from scratch, with the support of the Royal College, was really exciting and has led to hopefully some really nice material that people have enjoyed, but also been a really great developmental opportunity for me and given me the opportunity to engage with lots of really sort of experts in their field. So I think what really attracted me was that opportunity to do something new and have an impact outside sort of the local environment with which I work in, and certainly the experiences I've had so far have allowed me to do that.
That's really interesting. Thank you very much, Saif. Sophie, what can you tell us why you became an editor for the journal?
Yeah, so I was coming towards the end of my MD, and I had really enjoyed writing papers and had a couple of papers published within clinical oncology, and was just looking at ways of becoming more involved with some of the kind of Royal College different roles that they have on offer. And one of the things that was advertised at the time was to be an editor. And I just thought it was a really exciting opportunity to learn about the other side of publication of articles and, what goes on behind the scenes, learn a bit more about peer review, what makes a good article. So I decided that I would apply at that point, not knowing really whether I was experienced enough to do that. Obviously I was selected, and it's just been a really interesting couple of years learning about how to review a paper well, and also, what goes into a journal, how they look at all of the metrics behind the journal, how they decide what kind of papers have may increase their impact factor, what things people really like reading. And I just really enjoy that kind of side of things, thinking about the strategy and what it is that makes a good journal.
That's fantastic. Thank you very much. Sophie's talked about some of the things that she enjoys about being an editor. What have you enjoyed most about your role with the journal, perhaps particularly related to the podcasts?
Yeah, I guess there's lots of things there, really. I think starting off with the podcast, I think it's been, you know, having that platform of being an editor for a sort of a Royal College of Radiologists associated journal. It you know, when we approach people about interviews, it more often than not they say yes, and often it's linked to an article that's coming out. And so I've always found it really, really interesting speaking to people about the work that they've done, how they see it, how you know, how often sort of many years of work has led to sort of a final article, really. And often we're talking about how oncology is changing in real time, and that's something that's obviously really engaging and interesting. So it's that opportunity to sort of meet a lot of people through that. And you know, for instance, we had the opportunity to interview Sir Harpal Kumar, who at that time was the chief executive of Cancer Research UK, because they did a piece around some work they'd done with the government. So it's always quite diverse, some of the opportunities we've had. Similarly, we did something when we did the special issue on radiotherapy in low and middle income countries, spoke to a number of researchers based in Australia, the US, as well as someone who had been based in Cambodia. And it was really great that some of that work got picked up by like BBC World Service. And, you know, we were speaking to journalists about some of that because they wanted to cover the same issues. So it's really nice to be able to have that kind of impact. But I'd say actually, you know, above that, it's not just meeting people through interviews. I think the fact that we work as a really nicely gelled team of different people with different expertises is something I really enjoy. And everyone on the editorial board has so much expertise, but in general, you know, it's all really, you know, good people who really want to sort of give back to the community. And so there's I think a lot goes with that, and it's always been really great when, you know, sadly they've been a bit remote more recently, but when we've been able to go into London for the meetings, that's always been really vibrant and has been really great. I mentioned that Ben O'Leary started around the same time as a trainee, so it's been great sort of come through the ranks with them. So I imagine it'll be a similar thing with anyone joining new. You'll not only have the established people who are already there, but also the new people starting, you know, you kind of have a different relationship with as well. So I think that ability to make some really, you know, really meaningful relationships on a sort of professional, but sort of beyond that type of level, has also been something I've really enjoyed too.
Thank you very much, Sophie. I wondered, Sophie, did you have anything else that you found particularly enjoyable about being an editor?
So one of the other things that has been very successful for the journal has been the special editions, as Sophie touched upon. So there's been a number of special editions, which are roughly every quarter, I think. And recently I was put in charge of a special edition for cervical and endometrial cancer. So that has been a lot of work, but also just incredibly rewarding that we've pulled together a special issue of, you know, 8 to 10 articles that we approach people to write. And it's taken, you know, maybe 8, 9, even 12 months to come up with a finished article, but there's a real sense of achievement now. We're starting to see it in print, and just knowing a little bit more about what kind of work goes into producing a well-rounded special edition has been really interesting.
We know from the journal meetings that the special editions are often, that the articles in those are often the most read and gain a lot of citations as well for the journal.
Yeah, I was just going to say for Sophie, because I mean, I think the working on the special editions, special issues is such a fantastic thing to do, but clearly, you know, it is a lot of work. I'm sure it's really rewarding. But I just wanted to sort of touch on that in terms of, it must feel really kind of, it's one of those things which is sort of a challenge, but also a great opportunity, I guess, because what you're going to be putting out there is, it's really impactful, isn't it? Anyone thinking about gynae is going to see these special issues, see how these sort of articles interlace together. It must be like, I guess in some respects, a real privilege to be part of editing that. How did you kind of deal with that whole thing? And it must have been really enjoyable. It's not something I've been able to do yet, but it must have been fantastic, Sophie.
Yeah, it's been a really interesting journey right from when I was very first asked to do it. And just being able to take a seat and think about, you know, what is it that people want to know about cervical and endometrial cancer? Because we want to be both educational. I think that's what's really nice about clinical oncology, that there is an educational element as well as publishing up-to-date research. So it's just trying to get that kind of handle of having some educational content, but also making sure that it's as up to date as possible. And you know, using contacts that we've made and that other people throughout the editorial board have got to get some of the best people and international people writing articles for the journal. And as you said, some of those papers in previous special issues have been very highly read and very highly cited. So it's really exciting that we're on the verge of that being published and people being able to read those articles in print.
That's fantastic. Thank you. Do you feel that being an editor supports your clinical practice or your academic and research practice? Does sort of being an editor kind of contribute to that in some way?
So I think in terms of how does being on the editorial board support your clinical or academic practice? I mean, it has a massive role in both aspects of my practice. One of the main commitments when you join the editorial board is to provide peer review for some of the articles, as well as attending the editorial board meetings. So it means that you're continuing your professional development because you're reading articles, but you're also critically appraising them. So you're developing those aspects, and you're also, say, heavily involved in the journal, that you automatically are not just reading the articles that you're peer reviewing, but you're interested in everything else that's going on with the journal and also the podcasts, and therefore it just helps to keep yourself up to date and be able to use that within your clinical practice at work.
Yeah, I'd echo everything that Sophie has said, and it's really hard to put that tangibly, like how it can help you clinically, because yeah, it sort of hits you from so many different angles. I think even when we're discussing which special issues to be thinking about, then you've got sort of experts in their field saying how things have changed, even at the board meetings, and saying, okay, yeah, in sort of horizon scanning to 2-3 years time, this big thing is happening, and so this, you know, we need to think about a special issue in that time. So that's always really, really great, and it sort of touches, you know, across so many different subspecialties within oncology. It certainly, you know, it does help your sort of day-to-day clinical practice, I feel. And equally, I find sort of peer reviewing articles, sort of seeing them kind of before they're in their final form, that's always a really kind of meaningful academic discipline, and you always learn something clinically because you're seeing cutting edge research, you know, literally before it's out there. So yeah, just so many ways, really. And I'd also, sort of going back to what Sophie was saying around the sort of emphasis on education at the journal, I think that's something that's been, you know, really fantastic, that has been brought in by, you know, all of the editors, really. I think Charlotte had a big emphasis on it, and then Ben and yourself and many others have really led on that recently. And I just think that sort of drips through as well, because all this educational material is being produced by the journal, that kind of educates you while you're part of it. So yeah, just lots of different ways, really.
I wondered if there were certain challenges that you may have encountered in being an editor, and what strategies you might have developed to help overcome these.
For me, I think the challenges are probably the same for everybody, in that everybody is time pressured. So this is an extra commitment that you take on top of your normal day-to-day clinical work and other aspects of your life. So yeah, I think ideally when we're reviewing articles, it is time pressured because we're trying to make the process as streamlined for authors as possible, that they get peer reviewed and get that response back fairly quickly. But in terms of strategies of how to deal with that, I think, you know, as you peer review more papers, you do get a little bit slicker at knowing what it is that you're looking for and the kinds of comments, and being able to make those decisions perhaps a little bit quicker than you were at the start. Certainly with the special issue was when you approach people to write articles, obviously there's, you know, slips within time frames that you're expecting as well. So that was certainly a learning curve for me, that everybody's busy, and a few little gentle reminders here and there don't go astray either.
Again, I'd fully agree with Sophie. I think that with anyone considering wanting to join the journal, which I'd, you know, thoroughly recommend, I think one of the key considerations always is time commitments or other resource commitments. But what I would say is that you know, everybody who's involved with the journal also has those time commitments and realizes that, you know, you might not be able to respond to an email within 5 minutes or turn something around within unreasonable time frames. I think it's, you know, the sort of journal is built on that. And so I don't think anyone's ever sort of had a negative experience about, you know, having some external pressures that means that they're you know, getting undue stress because of journal commitments. I also think that, you know, like anything in life, that, you know, you make, you know, sort of time almost appears when you've got something as a commitment. And I think this is something that is so so tangibly beneficial to not just yourself, but I think generally sort of as a, you know, on a department level, I think everybody would understand, you know, how valuable this is, that, that, you know, people are inputting into a national journal with international reach, that, it, you know, in terms of extra commitments to take on, this is probably one of the easiest ones to make time for. But in terms of sort of personal strategies, I think, you know, I found that I've actually learned from people I've met across, you know, being part of the journal, and how they sort of go about doing things. And I guess it's about sort of having specific times in either the week or the month to dedicate to time on the journal. And you don't need much. It obviously goes up and down depending on what you're involved in. I can imagine with Sophie it would have been quite sort of high bandwidth more recently with the special issue. But in general, I think, you know, being able to support the peer review or other sort of journal meetings, they're only, you know, they're twice a year. So it's not really a time commitment that takes too much, I think. So again, if anyone's thinking that that's a concern, they should just definitely apply, because, you know, it will work out.
That's really, really good to know. Thank you. So turning to something slightly different, we saw that the impact factor for clinical oncology has recently increased, which is obviously really good news. But in the sort of journals, there's a bit of a conflict between trying to maximise impact factor and publishing articles that are likely to be highly cited, because that can then increase the impact factor. And also trying to sort of encourage submissions from authors and the visibility of research, perhaps from non-traditional academic groups, such as allied health professionals, for example, as well as continuing to publish stuff by clinicians and physicists and so on. How do you think clinical oncology should address that balance between trying to maximise its impact factor, but also trying to kind of encourage and foster public publication of research?
I'm happy to sort of kick off with that. And what I would say is that this is a great question to ask someone like Ananya. She takes on her role, because this is a, you know, it is clearly a very important strategic decision, and it's tricky, as you've sort of highlighted in your question. It's just getting that balance. I think, you know, at the end of the day, sort of, you know, there is a bit of competitiveness around journals, because we're trying to attract the best research, regardless of who the author is and what impact factor you might get out of it. It's about the best, like, clinically meaningful research or work being disseminated. And so, you know, impact factor is an important part of that, as anyone knows when they're, you know, submitting a piece of work that they do, or being invited to submit something there. What I guess I would say is that, I think clinical oncology, through its links with the college, I think it's really great in that it, you know, I think it takes its responsibility very seriously around sort of developing younger journals, younger authors, for instance, not just thinking about the bottom line around impact factor. And there are a number of awards, for instance, for trainees who submit their work, which should sort of encourage people to apply from that point of view as well. It's not, you know, and that can help with development in lots of ways. So I guess it's not just about the impact factor. It is about sort of that development. And I think one of the other things the journal really prides itself on, which still holds true, is how quickly it can turn around submissions in terms of a decision or publishing something. But I think it's fantastic that, you know, I think all those things are paying off in terms of being attracting good work, because, you know, the impact factor continues to grow. I think it's really hard, you know, where that balance is of, you know, citations versus impact. I guess in theory those things should even out, but it is a bit of a strange system now, because a lot of things get published online early, but the way impact factors are calculated are kind of the first year almost doesn't count, which is a bit strange. So, you know, particularly around COVID things, a lot of things have been cited really a lot in that first year, but none of that will be counted towards the impact factor of the journal it's published in. So it's kind of hard to judge base a strategy around something that is inherently a little bit kind of wobbly in its existence. So so yeah, those are kind of my thoughts on it, but there's clearly no easy right answer.
Oh, thank you, Saif. That is interesting that your insights are. Sophie, I wonder, do you have anything else to add about that?
Yeah, I think clinical oncology is very much a journal that welcomes articles and input from all different specialties, I guess. And, you know, as long as it's a good, robust piece of work, then which disciplinary team it came from doesn't matter so much. It's just got to be, you know, something that's going to appeal to our readership, both nationally and internationally, and is a good and robust article. So I think that's more important. And I agree with Saif, you know, obviously we do want to increase the impact factor year on year, but you can't necessarily select articles based on that. We also want it to be well-rounded. And I think that is also shown in the fact that we've got other sections of the journal, such as the Science in Focus and Instant Oncology and things like that, that aren't just, you know, phase three trials, or just makes the journal very well-rounded and encompassing lots of different aspects of clinical oncology and clinical sciences.
Thank you. So something slightly different again, you both review, peer review lots of papers for the journal. What advice would you have for authors where perhaps they haven't received favourable peer review for their submission?
So I think the main thing, if someone receives some feedback that perhaps isn't so favourable and it's been rejected from the journal, is to take those pieces of those comments or criticisms on board and really try and take from that what they can do to change the piece of work. They should have a think about, was it really the right journal for that piece of work, or is there another journal that it might sit better within? And just, you know, try to review what they've already written and see whether they can incorporate the changes, because, you know, we are trying to be constructive in our feedback. So there could well be some good pieces of advice that author can take to rewrite their manuscript and then submit it somewhere else, perhaps.
Yeah. I you know, fully agree with what Sophie said in that regard. I think as a researcher, I think all of us have submitted things to, not had it from clinical oncology, but to journals, and you get this massive ream of comments back that can feel really demoralizing. And the last thing you want to do is then sort of edit that, for instance, if you've got kind of a rejection with lots of things. But it is about kind of persevering, I guess, and sort of try and, you know, sometimes some of the things the reviewers say aren't necessarily correct. I mean, at the end of the day, they've, you know your research better than anybody else, but a lot of the time there is things that, that will improve it. And a lot of the time, the fact that things are being sent back to you that might not necessarily be right might speak to the way something was written or presented. So I think it's always an opportunity to learn and develop an article out of it. And I think invariably it makes the final piece better. And I think it's kind of touched on by what Sophie said. I think for all of us who act as peer reviewers, I try my best. I can't say I get it perfectly right, but I try and teach my students the same is, you know, try and kind of, you know, be as collaborative in what you write for. And we certainly get that guidance from clinical oncology as well. You know, when you write your comments back to someone who's put that work together, because you know, it's a lot of effort submitting things. And I think, you know, sometimes if you get something back really negative, that's not a particularly nice experience. I think one thing that I don't know where we're at with it exactly is that Nanya is trying to make the process of submitting more streamlined for the journal. And I think that's really valuable. And it sort of feeds into that peer review thing, because sometimes you spend so much time putting stuff into a website and getting everything aligned and things like that, that then when you get a negative comment back, you feel a little bit hard done by it. And so trying to kind of make that whole process streamlined, you know, I think is good for the whole process. So it's nice that the journal is sort of thinking proactively around that too.
Yeah, that both your responses seem to contain lots of sensible advice there. There's been a lot of discussion in the editorial board meetings about proposals internationally for a transition towards most research that's published being published as open access. So that means that anyone can view the article, and the funding for that open access would be paid by the authors of the article. So an example is Plan S. That's one example of this proposal. That could potentially have significant impact on journals which have a hybrid model of publishing, such as Clinic Oncology, where it's funded both through subscriptions, but then also open access payments. So what do you think about these proposals and the perhaps the impact that they could have for clinical oncology?
I have to say, I don't know the kind of full impact on the economics for clinical oncology. That's not a discussion that I'm party to. As a clinician and a researcher, actually, I think it's important that practice-changing research is available for people to be able to read open access and come back to. Time and time again. So, you know, and you know, as a researcher, you do want people to be able to read your research and take it forwards from there, you know, whether that's implementing it into their clinical practice or whatever that may be. So I do think open access is important. Equally, however, it depends on the researcher and which facilities they're with. You know, obviously, if you're with a university or something, then often they have ways of paying for the open access fee, but for researchers that may not have that open to them, then they could potentially be disadvantaged. So I think those are just some of my initial thoughts. I wonder if Soph's got anything to add.
I agree with everything Sophie said. I think it's a really, you know, it's an evolving area. It's, you know, something that people have been looking at for probably decades, but, you know, for what I've known, many years. And you know, it is probably, you know, as a user of research, it's one of the most frustrating things when you can't get access to a piece of research that you think is really valuable. And it's, it is a kind of complex thing how that's modeled. That, you know, is beyond my understanding in that respect. But I would say that, you know, we've seen kind of in the COVID pandemic as well that a lot of journals have kind of just waived all the sort of open access, this sort of work to, I guess, for the greater good at a time of crisis to have a lot of, you know, peer-reviewed work out there as open access. And a lot of, I think, you know, and there's been a lot of flexibility around that in that context. And I guess the question then is, you know, we've seen that changed. It gives a chance now to reflect as all the editors and publishers would be as to what have been the benefits of that, what have been the outlays of it. So I think it's as good a time as any to be thinking about that. But it's really hard to know, you know, exactly what needs to be done at this point, for our journal, I just know it's something that's looked at all the time, and the decisions are being made with a lot of, you know, careful thought. And certainly I think everybody involved is very sort of for that, that push towards getting the research out there as widely as possible. And I think that's some of the stuff that the journal does around kind of podcasts and a lot of the educational material linked to the college is get a lot of contact out there, which is essentially open access. So it's something that sort of is part of what clinical oncology wants to push for.
It'll be really interesting to see how things evolve in that space. Turning to something else now, how can more people be encouraged to take up editorial roles? You've both strongly encouraged people who are potentially interested to consider applying. So how can we encourage more people to apply, particularly perhaps trainees or junior consultants, and also to try and improve the diversity of representation amongst the editorial board?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's like anything in the world, the sort of diversity of views is only a good thing. And, you know, with newer trainees coming in, there's always a new diversity of thought because the experience of trainees is changing so much on an annual basis almost right now. So I think it's really important for the journal overall, but I also think that, you know, for anyone coming from all backgrounds, it's of such a it's so valuable being part of this journal. It's such a great experience, and so you'd hope, just by definition, then that diversity of people who are involved in oncology will filter through into the people who apply. But it is really important, and I know it's something that's valued throughout the journal. And people involved within it. So I think anybody who thinks, oh, that's not for me, or, you know, it's not the kind of thing that people like me might be doing, I don't, you know, it's clearly not the case. And if anything, the answer is the opposite for them.
Yeah, I agree. I think when I joined a couple of years ago, as I've already touched on, I wasn't sure whether I was really part of the mould for the editorial board because I didn't think I was experienced enough. I think both Charlotte and Ananya increase the diversity, whether that be experience or whatever. They just want to make sure that we've got all walks of life on the editorial board, because it's only going to make the journal better and more interesting and appeal to more people. So it was just very welcoming when I joined, and will continue to be so. So I think, you know, the way that we can hopefully get more people applying is to continue to get the word out there. This podcast, one of them. I think all of the editorial board members need to be sharing the fact that these jobs are being advertised with our trainees and with our other colleagues within our hospitals. But we want to kind of get the furthest reach possible so that people consider whether this is something that they want to do and can dedicate some time to. And if anybody wanted to contact myself or SAFE in advance, just to get a bit more insight from a kind of personal point of view, what the commitment involves, then both of us would be more than happy for them to contact us.
I think currently there are newer opportunities which are being advertised on the Royal College of Radiologists website as well for current editorial board vacancies.
Yeah, so there's quite a few vacancies actually. So we are changing the way that the editorial board is structured, which is a great opportunity to get more people involved. So I would really encourage people to go on the RCR website and have a look at what's being advertised and to have a look at the job descriptions.
Thank you both for joining me today for a really interesting discussion. We'd also like to thank some of the staff whose work often goes unseen behind the scenes of the journal, including Cathy O'Hara, Elsevier, and Holly Benson and Tracy Ronan in the editorial office. Thank you for taking the time to listen to this audio podcast. You'll find more podcasts on the Clinical Oncology Journal website at clinicalonologyonline.net. Thank you for listening.